Hello, welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa with the News Gazette today on Wednesday, February 18th, 2026. Hope you're having a great day on this beautiful, sunny, warm day today. On the front page, we have a large picture of some men golfing outside, and it's called Puttering Around. Jim Holdren, Dale Schweigert, Greg Fink, and Rick Wilson all line up shots on the ninth hole of the University of Illinois' Blue Course in Savoy on Tuesday. The group, along with Tim Kenny and Jeff Bauman, boast of playing 5 days a week, year-round, weather permitting, in another sign of spring. The owners of Danville Gardens are preparing for their April 15th reopening. Also on the front page, an article from Champaign County Court entitled, Champaign Woman Gets 16 Years for Fatal Stabbing. Carter, 68, took plea deal, admitting to second-degree murder of 71-year-old by Luke Taylor. A Champaign woman pleaded guilty to second-degree murder Tuesday after originally being charged with 4 counts of first-degree murder. According to Assistant State's Attorney Brooke Hinman, a doctor who examined 68-year-old DeWandi Carter determined that due to her past trauma with domestic violence, she believed that she was in danger from the victim, 71-year-old W.B. Curry of Champaign. Even though this belief was unreasonable due to Mr. Curry's physical condition, Hinman said the defendant's genuine belief made her able to plead down from first-degree charges. The incident occurred on November 16, 2024, when neighbors reported hearing shouting followed by moaning from a residence on the 2000 block of Cynthia Drive, where police were aware of a history of calls regarding domestic violence. Hinman said one witness also described seeing a black woman consistent with Carter's age walking out of that residence and around a corner quickly. When Champaign police arrived, Carter answered the door, and officers could see Mr. Curry inside lying on the floor. Carter took 1 minute and 40 seconds to allow officers to enter, Hinman said, just before they had to threaten to kick the door down. The victim had blood on his shirt, and Carter originally claimed that someone came in and did something to him, and she didn't know what was happening. Officers provided medical aid, but Mr. Curry was ultimately pronounced dead. Medical examiners determined that the stab wound in his chest, which was 7 inches deep, entered from front to back, left to right, downward. The penetrated area was the left ventricle of his heart. The knife was never located. While Carter originally denied involvement, only saying she argued with the victim, she eventually admitted that she stabbed him and said that she did so in self-defense. Hinman said Mr. Curry had mobility issues due to a recent stroke and other underlying health conditions. Mr. Curry's brother provided a victim impact statement at the plea hearing, saying that it was harder than he expected to lose his sibling. I hope that she has asked God for forgiveness, he said to the defendant. He said he was looking forward to closure now that the plea and sentencing were taking place. Carter also spoke briefly, saying she had asked for forgiveness and that she hated what had happened to the victim and his family. Carter pleaded guilty to 1 count of second-degree murder and saw all of the first-degree murder charges dismissed. A second case she was involved with was also dismissed. As part of the negotiated plea, she was sentenced to 16 years in the Illinois Department of Corrections. Carter had credit for 374 days of previously served time. Continuing on the front page, at the bottom of the page, from the Champaign County Executive's Office, an article with the heading, ICE Agents Ordered to Unmask While on County's Property, Proper Display of Badges and Judicial Warrants Required, by Jana Wiersema. Champaign County Executive Steve Summers has signed an executive order that aims to place certain restrictions on federal immigrant enforcement operations occurring on county property. This is about being proactive and making sure that our immigrant friends and neighbors know that we care about them and we want to protect them, said County Director of Administration Michelle Jett when asked if enforcement activities had previously occurred on county property. The order, which took effect on Tuesday, states that when such activities occur on county-owned property under the control of the executive's office, federal officials must remove face coverings and ensure continuous visibility of a badge issued by their respective agency during immigration enforcement operations. Additionally, the order states that a judicial warrant shall be presented to the facility's security and/or reception office. Upon being presented with such a warrant, county staff are instructed to contact both their supervisor and county executive's office. County officials, along with leaders from organizations that serve the local immigrant population, presented the executive order at a Tuesday morning press conference in the Bennett Administration Center. In the event that county personnel see someone wearing a mask and gear but not recognizable law enforcement uniform, they are to call 911 immediately rather than try to figure out what's going on themselves, Jett said. When it comes to levels of government, the executive order states, in the event of a conflict between this order and state and or federal law, the state and or federal law will control. When asked what would happen if there is such a conflict between state and federal law, Jett replied, that sounds like a fight between the state and the federal administration. Honestly, I think we would probably default to state in that moment, she added. I'm honestly not sure. I'm hoping that we really don't run into this very specific example. I think it would really depend on what the conflict is about. According to Jett, examples of county properties that would fall under the executive order include the Bennett Administration Center, the Animal Control Building, the Highway Department facility, the Brookins Center, and the Coroner's Office. However, she noted that the order does not apply to judicial or detention facilities such as the courthouse and jail. Sheriff Dustin Howerman told the News Gazette that the Illinois Trust Act prohibits us from cooperating with ICE, especially at the jail. We can't notify ICE of any non-public information, so we wouldn't be able to tell them if somebody's in custody whose status is unknown or whose status is undocumented, he said. We can't allow ICE access to our facilities. On the other hand, the courthouse is a public facility, which means that ICE can come and go as they want, Howerman said. However, he added that the courthouse needs to be a place that anyone, including undocumented individuals, can access without being fearful of ramifications. Governor J.B. Pritzker recently signed legislation that, among other things, prohibits the civil arrest of anyone in and around courthouses who are attending certain state court proceedings, the governor's office announced in December. The legislation states that the term civil arrest does not apply to any of the following: an arrest for an alleged criminal offense under federal, state, or local law, an arrest for violating a condition of probation, parole, pretrial release, or supervised release if an arrest for such a violation is otherwise authorized by law, an arrest supported by judicial warrant or judicial order authorizing the arrest. The law provides protection for parties, witnesses, potential witnesses, or court companions as they attend state court proceedings and come and go from the premises. However, Howerman noted that this is more of a civil measure that creates a vehicle for individuals to sue if immigration enforcement occurs on or near a courthouse, but it doesn't really give us, as law enforcement, leverage to take any action against ICE. We have had ICE over the last year or so, maybe once or twice at the courthouse, and they have not been doing any kind of, I'm not aware of any wide-scale operation, he said. Everything I'm aware of that's happened in the county has been targeted, and that includes when ICE was at the courthouse last year. You might have heard about that. They were here for two people, it was a specific target, and I verified with them that point. We certainly haven't seen immigration enforcement at the level that we can compare to what we've seen in Chicago or other major cities, said Immigrant Services of Champaign-Urbana Executive Director Maria Jimenez. But there has certainly been enforcement that has taken place in Champaign County in situations where it's incredibly difficult to confirm whether or not there was actually a warrant that was presented or whether or not it was done so because it was necessary. In discussing the origins of the executive order, Summers said that Champaign County Board members Matt Sullard approached him with the idea several months ago, and the process of its creation has taken longer than expected as his office reached out to other government officials, county board members, and local organizations. Summers also thanked Jett for her outreach community groups and assistance with drafting the order. When I asked Executive Summers to issue an executive order outlining a position against the targeting, harassing, and bullying behavior displayed by Trump's ICE agents, I didn't fully grasp how important it would become, Sullard said. Since that time, we've seen families separated, children used as bait, and American citizens murdered in the streets, all against the backdrop of repeated lies from the Trump administration. The executive order enacts common sense requirements to ensure due process and accountability, he added. Sullard also thanked community partners for their collaboration on the effort. Francisco Bears, director of the University YMCA's New American Welcome Center, said that the people his organization serves need to feel safe going to city or county buildings. The hard truth of the matter is, despite ongoing efforts to make Champaign County a place where all residents feel safe and welcome, many do not, he said. Sadly, while this has long been the case for some, news coming out of L.A., Chicago, and the Twin Cities has only made matters worse. That's why this executive order is an important step in the right direction. And the last article we'll cover here on the front page is an opinion piece by Jim Dye with the title, Candidate Files Suit Over Typo on the Ballot. Dabrowski's first name, Ted, misspelled as Tad. The office of Champaign County Clerk and Recorder Aaron Ammons is in hot political water again, this time for misspelling the name of Republican gubernatorial candidate Ted Dabrowski on the primary ballot. The incorrect ballot spelling is Tad. Dabrowski's first name is Ted. Champaign County State's Attorney Julia Reed said she is working diligently to get this issue resolved. If voters see the name Tad on the ballot, they should vote for Ted, she said. Reed's also said Ammons' office is notifying Republicans casting ballots ahead of the March 17th primary of the error to ensure that they understand the situation. Reed's exchanged weekend emails with Jared Stock, a Decatur lawyer representing Dabrowski, to settle the dispute. But Stock later filed a lawsuit in Champaign County Circuit Court seeking corrective action. Reed said no hearing has yet been scheduled. The lawsuit states that Ammons discovered the ballot error on February 13th. By that time, it goes on to state, approximately 4,000 to 5,000 ballots with the misspelling had been mailed, and approximately 200 in-person early voters had cast ballots with the error. The Dabrowski campaign contends the error diminishes respect for his campaign and presents a risk for voter confusion. The lawsuit requests a correction of the mistake on the official ballot and all ballots and election material. But in a subsequent letter, Reed said Ammons has created a specimen ballot with the correct spelling, and that will be posted at all local voting locations. She also said that all Republican voters will be provided a notice indicating that there was a misspelling of the gubernatorial candidate's name. We certainly agree that a voter who votes for Tad Dabrowski intends to vote for Ted Dabrowski and would not oppose any court order to that effect if needed, Reitz wrote. But the lawsuit rejects Ammons' corrective measures. It said the correction undertaken by Ammons is not plain and concise and does not specify the error, and that the error was the act of the county clerk. Noting that the name identification is a fundamental requirement to electing success, Dabrowski's lawyer said official ballots are subject to legal challenge by other candidates, and that Ammons does not have the authority to adjudicate or prejudice the objections of others interested in challenging a vote tailed for Ted that was cast for Ted Dabrowski. The lawsuit asks the court to bar Ammons from distributing ballots with the name misspelling, or alternatively suspend all in-person early voting and prohibition of processing any returned mail-in ballots until further order of the court. As another alternative, the Dabrowski campaign suggested Ammons be ordered to reprint all official ballots, or that uncorrected ballots be accompanied by a 5x8-inch card that reads as follows. The Champaign County Clerk caused the official ballot to be printed with an error in the spelling of a candidate's name. When you see Tad Dabrowski, the certified candidate is Ted Dabrowski. The suit also asked for an order to tally all votes cast for Tad Dabrowski as a vote for Ted. Ammon's name is also on the ballot. The incumbent Democrat is seeking re-election. So far, no Republican is running against him, although one could be slated by the party after March's primary. Let's head over to another opinion piece by J. Mark Powell in his Holy Cow History. Today, there's a picture of a car driving through very tall snowbanks, actually over the car, taller than the car, on February 8, 1936, in Windom, Minnesota, about 150 miles southwest of Minneapolis. And the article is called The Big Chill of 1936. Temperatures plunge, ice everywhere. Transportation is frozen in its tracks. An Arctic Armageddon. Winter 2026, right? Think again. The six is correct, but the other three digits are off, because this month is the 90th anniversary of the coldest February on record in the lower 48 states, the winter of 1936. How cold was it, you ask? Cold enough that a meteorological phenomenon occurred that hasn't happened in the 90 winters since. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Winter started out pretty much the same as usual, in the most unusual of times known as the Great Depression. The weather had been contrary in recent years. For instance, extreme drought and strong winds had combined 2 years earlier to create the Dust Bowl, leaving 500,000 people homeless and ultimately displacing 3.5 million across Oklahoma, Texas, Kansas, and beyond. After that, Mother Nature took a breather. Then, in February of 1936, Americans discovered just how bad weather could be. The month started off cold and grew colder, and colder still. Across the country, the mercury in thermometers kept dropping. Just how bad was it? On February 15th, the temperature dropped to minus 60 Fahrenheit in North Dakota, a state record that stands to this day. And that's not the wind chill, mind you. It was the actual temperature. Langdon, North Dakota, stayed below zero for 41 consecutive days. Then there were blizzards. Note the plural, because they came back to back, one right after the other. They roared out of the Great Plains and raged all the way to the upper New England, coating that region with nearly 3 feet of snow. Drifts of 10 to 15 feet were reported in some rural areas. In an era when most American products were moved by rail, train travel came to a standstill. Roads were too snowy for trucks, for vehicles that didn't manage to drive. The brutal, brittle air risked ruining engines. The result was what would be today called supply chain interruptions. Cities such as Boston, Chicago, and Cleveland were paralyzed. The toll was especially hard on livestock. Countless horses, cattle, sheep, and pigs died of exposure, a serious blow to the bottom line of farmers already struggling with low prices due to the lingering depression. Perhaps nature's greatest show of force came in St. Louis, where the Mississippi River froze over. That's right, the mighty Mississippi, Big Muddy, Old Man River, the father of waters, was turned into a gigantic ice cube, nearly 1 mile wide. Brave souls ditched the landmark Eads Bridge and crossed to the East St. Louis on foot over the ice. Although the Mississippi had frozen over before, it was an exceedingly rare occurrence, and it hasn't happened again in the 90 years since either. Estimates of the number of deaths from the extreme weather event vary. It was certainly in the hundreds. Iowa alone reported 20 confirmed fatalities. Still, February 1936's average temperature of 25.2 degrees in the United States still holds a record as the coldest February ever. The worst month of all was January of 1977's average of 21.9 degrees. Horrific as that was, nature wasn't finished inflicting misery on Americans that year. Just 5 months later, the mercury swung in the opposite direction. A ferocious heat wave baked much of the United States in July of 1936, triggering a second round of the Dust Bowl and claiming the lives of more than 5,000 people. There is much conversation these days about climate change and how traditional weather patterns are changing, to which 1936 could easily snicker and say, "Hold my beer." Let's keep going under our communities with another article that tackles the weather. This one's from Danville by Jennifer Bailey with the title, "Eager for Spring." From Danville Gardens, with warmer temperatures, the business and area gardeners are preparing for the planting season. With 60-degree weather in February, it's hard not to start thinking spring will be here soon, and that means a new planting season. It's not just an exciting time for customers, it's also exciting for Danville Gardens co-owner Nathan and Lisa Campbell. Their daughter Kendall and her husband Andrew Swanson and their two children have moved back to the area to start learning the ropes as Nathan and Lisa look to retire in the next few years. There are also changes this year for their locations. There are new roofs on the greenhouses at the main Danville Gardens location at 1307 Cleary Avenue. And both the main location and the now two-year-old building at 3585 North Vermilion Street will open at the same time this year on April 15th. It's now 33 years that the Campbells have owned Danville Gardens. They were only the third owners. Danville Gardens started around 1910 by Billy Welchel. The original greenhouse still stands. Walter and Mildred Ahrens were the second owners for 54 years. The Campbells took over in 1993 and have enjoyed a successful run that Nathan said they are excited they'll keep the business in the family when he and Lisa retire. Andrew, originally from Iowa, moved to Danville with Kendall and their family about 9 months ago. "We're kind of Nathan and Lisa's retirement plan in the next, you know, five-ish years," Andrew said. Nathan said they're excited. Andrew and Kendall will buy the business from them. They're still working on a timeline for their retirement, Nathan said, adding that Andrew and Kendall will be working and learning the business over the next few years. Kendall studied engineering and worked with real estate, but Andrew said in talking with Nathan and Lisa that he and Kendall thought this would be a great opportunity for them. "The family aspect of it, of just getting to be so close, I can literally run home and break and go see them," Andrew said. "There's a lot to learn with this business," but he also said that in-laws are great to work with and learn from. Andrew said the customer base that they have and the people who are so loyal just speaks a lot to how hard they work and how hard the team works here. "It's a great place to work, even for just the last 8 months or 9 months," Andrew said. The business was a natural fit for the family. Nathan grew up in the greenhouse industry. He was working in Virginia, and they started looking at having a greenhouse themselves. In a greenhouse grower magazine, there was an ad for Danville Gardens. When they moved to Danville to run the business, there was about 70,000 square feet of greenhouse. They tore down 40,000 square feet and kept the one original greenhouse, which is called House 1, in the back today. Then they rebuilt everything else and tied it all together, now having about 100,000 square feet of greenhouse space. The seasonal garden center is open from April 15th to June. They are closed July and August to grow mums and items for the fall. Then they're open in September and October. So we really are only open about 5 months of the year. So we do a lot in a hurry, Nathan said. Our spring season is our big one. We make about 80% of our money in about 6 weeks. He said they open a little bit later in the year because they want to make sure that the weather is cooperative for everybody and the business can get busy right away. For the ferns, they get them as a small start in August or September. "It's not full, but we have something here all the time," he said about the greenhouse space. Geraniums are big, too, but they are doing a little something different this year where they purchase the unrooted cuttings and will root their own starts, which means a little less crop time for the geraniums in the greenhouse, trying to be a little more efficient, Nathan said. In the off-season, from October to last week, they also recovered about 80% of their greenhouse roofs with plastic. Excuse me. "It's now brighter in the greenhouse. with more light for more growth. Nathan said when they changed the roofs before, about every 12 to 15 years, they could see a two-week reduction in crop time. He said when the temperature this winter was below zero, the greenhouses are still kept in the 60s. With a warm spring, and if it comes early, the flowers and plants will get more light and heat, and the crops will be a little quicker in growing. On Monday and Tuesday, they were to plant about 10,000 perennials. They also typically have about 6,000 ferns and more than 30,000 hanging baskets. Next week, they have several thousand plants, small starts for those coming in, and about 100 in a tray that they'll plant in baskets. We've got a lot to do. Next week is going to get really busy, Nathan said. They will also have a couple hundred thousand of individual pots. They don't grow the bedding flats, but sell them. We just don't feel like we have the space to do everything, so those get outsourced from a grower in Michigan, but we're growing most of what we sell, and we like that, Nathan said. They have a production crew of about 10 to 20 employees. During the spring, they have up to 50 full and part-time workers. We've got some great help, Nathan said, adding that a lot come back every year. And there's a picture there with the co-owner, Nathan Campbell, in the greenhouse with the ferns on the overhead on the ceiling in pots, all in many, many rows. Another article on under our communities from Urbana City Council by Jana Wiersema with the heading, Three Candidates Vying for Ward 4 Vacancy. Three candidates have emerged to fill Ward 4 vacancy left by former Alderwoman Jaya Colsetti, Wendy Edwards, Verdell Jones III, and Karen James. There were initially seven applicants, but one lived outside of the ward and another had not lived there long enough to be eligible, said Mayor Deshaun Williams. And then from five, there became three. For one reason or another, he said Monday at the committee of the whole session, we had a couple of people drop out, which again, understand, is a tall task. So I just want to say thank you to the final three individuals who had amazing interviews. We had great conversations, and I don't think there is a wrong option here. Each candidate was given 3 minutes during the committee meeting to introduce themselves to the council. Jones, a Champaign Central alum, is a former Indiana University basketball star who also played professionally in France, Greece, and Japan. He previously filed to run for Urbana mayor in the 2021 election, but was disqualified. Objections to his petition included that he had filed the wrong form and had not lived in the city for the preceding year. He currently serves as a firefighter for the city of Champaign. Edwards is a senior software engineer for the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, according to her LinkedIn profile. James has been a resident of Urbana since 1998 and said that she works at a cancer center. Per state statute, Williams is up to 60 days from the date of Colsetti's resignation to recommend an appointment to the council, which must then vote on the appointment within 30 days, officials said in previous announcements about the vacancy. Colsetti's last meeting was February 2nd. She announced her resignation in January, ahead of a move outside of her ward. And we're going to stop here for a moment with our first section of the News Gazette, dated February 18th. I will be back shortly.